Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. A bite from a tick or a mosquito can leave you with more than an itchy rash. 557 cases of mosquito-borne West Nile virus were recorded in the U.S. last year, and that's pretty good considering that yearly totals frequently top 2,000, according to the Centers for Disease Control. And evidence suggests that upward of 450,000 people may contract deer tick-borne Lyme disease each year. So minor short-term discomfort should be the least of your worries as you plan outdoor activities this summer. Avoid getting bit to avoid getting very sick. Consumer Reports Health and Science reporter Catherine Roberts covers insect repellent testing as well as the diseases spread by mosquitoes and ticks. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Thanks for having me in.
So tell us more about Lyme disease. It's spread in recent years because the deer ticks that carry it are spreading across the country, right?
That's right. Scientists think there's probably a lot of different reasons that Lyme disease is spreading. Increased suburbanization, increased deer populations. There's a lot of different reasons, but yes, it's definitely trending upwards. Every year there's more cases, you know, that the CDC is able to count. And Lyme disease, you know, it's treatable. Most people with a round of antibiotics will get better. There are some people who go on to experience much longer term symptoms that can be really like horrible and frustrating. So it's definitely something that you want to avoid.
I think the thing about Lyme disease, as far as I understand, is it's not always diagnosed right away. People don't know that they're sick.
That's right. That's
or,
right.
Or what it is that's caused it.
That's right. Majority of cases, we think, present with a rash, a very distinctive target-shaped rash. And in those cases, it's pretty easy for doctors to tell what it is. But there are cases that don't have a rash, or it's hard to see, or you miss it. And in that case, it's sort of, you know, fever, pain. It may be hard to diagnose, especially if you are someone who potentially traveled to an area that has Lyme disease or where Lyme disease is very common, and then you're trying to get diagnosed somewhere else where doctors may not be as familiar with it.
And what's West Nile virus like? It's not as, I don't really know anybody who's ever had it.
Right. It's definitely not as common to be diagnosed, but in similar ways to a lot of other diseases, it's kind of fever, pain, and then it's rarely, but it happens, will turn into a very serious, encephalitis disease. Okay. So that can be fatal.
And what do we know about the downturn in West Nile cases last year? Pandemic?
Hard to say. I don't know for sure. The West Nile cases kind of fluctuate every year. In the last couple of decades, there's not necessarily a super clear trend line. I'm not sure. I can't say for sure. I think it's definitely possible that maybe not as many cases of Lyme disease West Nile got diagnosed because of the pandemic, but it's really unclear.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about insect repellents and how well they work nowadays. I think the testing that you did, and I read about it, was kind of interesting because it reminded me of those old Off commercials where they don't bite, they don't even light, you know, with people sticking their arms in a box of mosquitoes.
That's right. We do test them by having like very brave volunteers put insect repellent on their arm, and then we have them stick their arms into a cage full of mosquitoes. it's pretty impressive. So the good news from our testing is that there are a lot of products that we recommend. There's quite a number of ones that work really well. The big takeaway from our testing is that you have to get the right active ingredient. And so what we found is there are three that are kind of the most reliable. The first, which makes up the vast majority of our recommended products, is DEET in concentrations of 15 to 30%. So that's really the most reliable, definitely the most that we have in our tests that we've found have done. What's that?
What is DEET?
DEET, it's a chemical that I believe was developed by the military in mid part of the last century.
Okay.
So it's just a chemical.
mosquitoes don't like.
Yeah. It's It's been tested quite a bit for safety, so it has a quite a good safety record. There have been some reports of some side effects, but you know, it's really commonly used, and those reports are really, really rare. So, you know, I think people can be secure in that it's safe. We don't recommend going over 30% concentration. You can buy higher, but there's really very little marginal benefit to that. And there's no use in exposing yourself to sort of higher concentrations.
Is there any benefit in terms of how you apply the repellent, whether it's a spray or a lotion or whatever?
So yes, in our tests, we've found that products with DEET that use this 15 to 30% DEET, we do have a couple of recommended products that are the towelettes, the wipes.
Oh, okay.
And we have one, maybe two, sorry, lotions with DEET, in that concentration range. However, with the other active ingredients that we do have recommended products in, which are 20% picaridin, mm-hmm, and 30% oil of lemon eucalyptus, we don't have any products that we recommend that are any form other than a spray, basically.
Okay.
So for those, you would want to stick to a spray.
So, right. So these are the alternatives to DEET.
That's right.
Why would one need an alternative to DEET?
I think it's mostly a matter of preference. I know there are people who prefer to avoid DEET, and luckily there's really effective options.
Okay.
If that's something that you want to avoid. I mean, again, you know, DEET does have a good safety profile, but it's also totally reasonable to avoid it if that's something that you want to do. So you do have options.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I'm talking with Consumer Reports health and science journalist Catherine Roberts. She covers Consumer Reports insect repellent testing, as well as the diseases spread by mosquitoes and ticks. That's what we're talking about today. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what's picaridin? Is it something natural or something?
It's a chemical that's derived. So it's not naturally occurring, but it's derived from a chemical in black pepper plant.
Okay.
And it's not like an essential oil, but it is derived from a plant in a chemical process. And that's one that has, I think, been popping up more and more in recent years. And we've got three products in our ratings that use picaridin. Two of them have 20% picaridin. One has 10%. We tend to recommend going with the 20% concentration, since that's the majority of what we've seen to be
and
effective.
When you talk about alternatives, does picaridin work as well as DEET, or not quite, or what, well enough, or?
There's a range. So we have, you know, products that kind of, one that's kind of in the high range of effectiveness, a couple that are kind of in the mid range of effectiveness in among the ones that we recommend. And when we say effectiveness, we really judge that by basically how long the repellent will repel mosquitoes, basically.
Okay.
So we sort of, the score is how long it takes for a mosquito to get past that repellent. So
yeah,
we do have a range.
That brings me to another aspect of your testing, which kind of cracked me up. You have people sort of walk around for 10 minutes to make them work up a sweat.
That's right. We try to make it as, you know, it's a very controlled lab setting, but we do try to do these little things that kind of mimic real life. Like, you're not just sitting in one spot while you're wearing an insect repellent necessarily. You're moving around and stuff. And of course, you know, it's important to remember if you are like swimming in the ocean or sweating a lot, that may wash off the repellent. So, you know, it's important to kind of keep an eye out for those things, kind of keep a watch on the mosquitoes. And if they're starting to bite again, then, you know, you can reapply.
Have you ever reported on the fact that some people are not bothered by mosquitoes that much?
I haven't done that much reporting on that, but it is true that there does seem to be some people who are simply more tasty. I happen to be a person who I generally can avoid mosquito bites, but my mom is someone that they love.
Yeah. I mean, it would have to be swarming for mosquitoes to bother me, but yeah, I don't know if it's good, you know, or I should be offended. Oil of lemon eucalyptus. What about that?
So that's also a, again, not a, an essential oil in the way that you think of them, like lemon oil or whatever. It's, again, an ingredient derived from a plant, but in a chemical process. And it's we've got four in our ratings that have 30% oil of lemon eucalyptus that are effective. So that's, yeah, that's another really good option if you're interested in that.
And here's two that I'm not sure. Okay. IR3535 and 2-undecanone.
Yes. Yeah.
Those are two different.
That's right. Those are two ingredients that the CDC does recommend, because those are, and CDC and EPA okay. recommend as insect repellent ingredients that are effective. And in our tests, you know, we've found that, you know, they have some efficacy for some number of hours, just not as much as okay. as the three ingredients that we recommend. So, you know, they're out there and available, but we recommend sticking with sort of the three ingredients that we know are doing the best job.
What about so-called natural insect repellents? What are those?
So, I mean, natural in this context, as in many contexts, doesn't really have a definition. When we talk about it, we mean ones that are based solely with active ingredients that are essential oils, like citronella oil or soybean oil or things like that. And those we've found really do not last very long. They're pretty much at the bottom of our ratings for how long that they're going to protect you. So we recommend against them.
Okay. Like the wristbands, the citronella candles, all of that kind of stuff.
That's right. That's another set of things that there's just not a lot of good evidence. And in fact, some evidence from other labs and things that those are not very effective as far as, you know, area repellents, especially like the wristbands. It's really not, it's not enough. It has a repellent in it, but it's just not enough and not applied in the right ways to be protective.
You are not fans of the combination sunscreen insect repellent products. Why is that?
That's right. That's because sunscreen needs to be reapplied every 2 hours. And there's really no call to do that with insect repellent. It's like we said, you know, our top rated ones will last for 5-6 hours. So there's no need to sort of be reapplying those chemicals mm-hmm. onto your skin. Whereas sunscreen, as we know, you know, you have to be very diligent with reapplying it in order to get continue to be protected. So that's why we don't recommend that.
And speaking of applying it, is there a right and a wrong way to apply? I mean, if you're using a lotion, you know, you said that's what, but it, can it, is there a right way to use a lotion?
I mean, it's sort of similar. So if you're, you know, like getting ready for a beach day or whatever, you would want to put your sunscreen on first and let that do its thing. And then insect repellent goes after that. If you have a lotion insect repellent or a spray insect repellent or a wipe, the key things to remember are only using that on exposed skin. So you don't want to, it's not effective if it's underneath like your clothes. So only on exposed skin, and really for insect repellent, you only need as much as you need basically to cover the skin in a thin layer. So with sunscreen, you know, we know that you want to kind of layer it on. It's good to layer it on. That's not really the same thing with insect repellent. Oh, a thin layer is enough.
Okay.
So I, you know, when I use it with, I usually use sprays, and I'll just spritz it over my skin, and I usually rub it in a little bit just to make sure that I get all my skin covered. That's not necessarily necessary. It's not like it needs to be rubbed in. It's more to just make sure that you get all the exposed skin
covered.
Just
spread it around, not necessarily rub it in.
That's right.
And what about clothes? I mean, I think I've reported in the past that they were working on insect repellent clothes in and of themselves, but I don't know if that's come out yet. But you're saying it doesn't matter that the repellent won't work if you put it on underneath that where it goes under clothes.
That's right. So a couple of things with clothes, you can use the insect repellents that we use in our ratings, DEET, picaridin, oil of lemon eucalyptus. You can use those over your clothes. So if you've especially with mosquitoes, they can actually bite you through like really tight clothing. So if you're wearing leggings or something, it can be a good idea to spritz some DEET or oil of lemon eucalyptus or whatever over your clothes. That's definitely a good thing to do, especially if you're hiking or something and trying to avoid ticks. There are clothes that use a different sort of, it's an ingredient called permethrin. It's a pesticide. And they do sell clothes that have that basically impregnated in the cloth. Okay. You can also purchase permethrin and spray your clothes yourself. And those are, most of the evidence that I've seen recently about permethrin has to do with ticks. There is some good evidence for efficacy against ticks. But you don't, you know, it's definitely an option, but you can't spray permethrin on your skin. So it doesn't work on exposed skin. You know, you can't put it on your face or your hands or anything like that. So that's something to keep in mind with that as well.
And just real quick, I mean, you've written off citronella candles. What about home, you know, out in the backyard on the deck kind of a thing? Is there anything you can do for area prevention?
For mosquitoes, the big one is eliminating standing water, and even a little bit of standing water can be a breeding ground for mosquitoes. So it's important to keep an eye on that. If you have a bird bath, make sure to clean that out very regularly. Eliminate any, you know, pots, whatever is sitting around that could be collecting water for mosquitoes. That's really important. And then if ticks are a problem in your yard, it's really a matter of cleaning up brush, mowing frequently. They like the tall grass. They like the sort of leaf litter and things like that. So keeping that stuff nice and tidy in your yard is important.
I found a nice standing fan helps too. You can just turn that on and it blows all the bugs away. Well, the mosquitoes.
That's right. And there is some good evidence on simply an oscillating fan will help kind of cut down the mosquitoes.
Well, Catherine Roberts, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, too.
Catherine Roberts is a health and science journalist at Consumer Reports. She covers Consumer Reports insect repellent testing, as well as the diseases spread by mosquitoes and ticks. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration last month approved a controversial new drug designed to treat Alzheimer's disease. But it's starting with, like I said, it's controversial, starting with a staggering annual price tag of $56,000 per patient. Wall Street Journal reporter Joseph Walker covers the biotechnology and pharmaceutical industries. Welcome to the show, Joseph.
Thank you for having me.
The drug is Aduhelm. It's made by Biogen, right? Before we get to the cost issue, there's another controversy about its effectiveness. What's the problem there?
Well, some would argue that we don't really know if it's effective or not. The problem is that when Biogen was conducting, there were two big phase three studies which are needed for FDA approval. They did an analysis at like the midway point, which is something which is common, and they decided that statistically it was very unlikely that the drug was actually going to work, and so they halted the study. They said it's futile to go forward, so we're just going to stop. And that was that. It was, you know, a big disappointment in the field, one of many that have gone on over recent years. And then several months later, they came back and said, wait a minute, we got some more data from these studies, and it looks like the drug works. But the problem is that the data is a mess because they stopped the study midway, and that's a no-no with these trials. But the other problem is that only one of the studies actually showed a benefit in slowing the progression of cognitive decline. And the other study did not show a statistically significant benefit. So it's messy.
So, all right. Well, why did the Food and Drug Administration approve it then, and do so, by the way, over the objections of the agency's own Drug Statistics Office?
It's a good question, and I think it's one that a lot of people are asking. I think on the FDA's argument would be that when you look at all this data in its totality, and you really go into it with a fair mind, that there is a reasonable likelihood that this drug is actually doing something in patients. And part of that is because of the mechanism by which it works. And so essentially what it does is you get these infusions every month, and this drug goes into the brain and it clears this protein called amyloid and from your brain. And we know that the drug does do that because of doing imaging scans. They do PET scans with this. And so it's clear that the drug is clearing the amyloid from the brain. And this has been a target for Alzheimer's treatments for a long time, because we know that this stuff, amyloid, builds up in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. And so number one, it's clearing the amyloid. Number two, it does, there is evidence from these trials that people who got the drug had a slower decline than the people who didn't. The problem, as I was alluding to earlier, is that when you do these clinical trials, there are all sorts of biases and that occur. And so you really want to do the trials in the most rigorous way possible to make sure that you're not getting a false positive. And those are the concerns that people have about why they approved it.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Joseph Walker. He covers biotechnology and pharmaceutical industries for the Wall Street Journal. And we're talking about the new FDA-approved drug Aduhelm, made by Biogen. We've been talking about what it does. Let's talk about what it costs. $56,000 a year. When you said it needed to be infused, you need to get an infusion monthly. For how long? I mean, how long does this go on?
Indefinitely.
Okay.
Theoretically, as I mean, you know, every patient will be different, but you know, theoretically, if you're not having side effects, which can occur with this drug, if your doctor thinks that it's having some sort of benefit, you would at least in Biogen's eyes, stay on it forever. There is some controversy over whether that's really needed or not, but yeah, so that's the short answer.
And then the FDA narrowed its guidance for the drug, saying Aduhelm should only be used for patients in the early stages of the disease. What do they mean by early stages? Because a lot of times people don't know they have it at the early stages.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's a really good point. So basically what happened there is Biogen studied this drug in people with, the technical terms are mild cognitive impairment and mild Alzheimer's dementia, right? So these are two categories of people who they've been diagnosed, they're having memory problems, but they can still care for themselves. They're not sort of helpless by any means. But they're declining. And the reason they did that was because all these Alzheimer drug studies had failed in the past over and over and over again. And gradually people start to think, well, you know, there's probably a point at which we're not really going to be able to help people because they've declined already so much. So we're just going to stick to these really narrow set of patients. And then when the FDA approved the drug, to the sort of puzzlement of some in the medical community, they didn't specify that it should just be these early stage patients. They just said Alzheimer's patients broadly. And that was a concern because number one, you might get, you know, maybe 4 million or so people who do not fit into that early stage category, who have Alzheimer's, seeking treatment, because who wouldn't seek out treatment for such a terrible disease, mm-hmm. who really don't stand any chance of benefiting from it. So it's kind of giving some false hope maybe. And then the other concern, of course, is that if you do have all those people who aren't going to benefit, it's going to cost the government a whole lot of money because Medicare pays for it.
Yeah. All right. So speaking of that, 56 grand a year forever. Some analysts fear it could wreck Medicare finances. why is it so expensive?
Well, and just to a small point of clarification here, okay. which we wrote about recently, is that so the $56,000 is a the estimate of Biogen for the average patient. But the thing about the drug is that it's dosed according to how much you weigh. So it's like 10 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. And so if you weigh more than a certain amount, it's going to cost more. If you weigh less, it'll cost less. Some estimates that a researcher here in New York did recently found that they thought that the average price could be more like $60,000 based on the population weight, based on the average weights of the population. Why is it so much? I mean, it's a mystery, frankly, why or how pharmaceutical companies price their drugs generally.
Anyway, right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of arbitrary in some sense. I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's what they can get away with, you know. How much can they charge without incurring the wrath of insurers that will restrict the usage of the drug or government pushback? I mean, that's something companies are afraid of these days, getting higher regulations from Washington.
And what about Medicare finances? Because of course we're talking about a population that is Medicare eligible.
Yeah. It's mostly Medicare patients that will be getting the drug. I think, you know, at least 80% or so, the company has said. And for those folks, so this is a drug. It's not a pill that you can go pick up in your pharmacy. You have to get it infused in an infusion center.
Okay.
And so with those types of drugs, that falls under this the Medicare doctor insurance. That's Part B. And in that part, some people are going to have 20% copays for this drug, which will be very expensive. Some people have like Medigap insurance and stuff like that that will help them take away some of those costs. But there could be some significant costs for people out of pocket for it. And I guess the other thing to say is we're sort of speculating. This drug just went on the market, you know, about a month ago now. So there's all sorts of estimates out there about how much it's going to cost the government or how much it's going to cost taxpayers, really. But you know, it could very quickly get up to billions of dollars a year in the next couple of years, I think. Maybe over a billion next year.
Yeah, and when I've heard reports about that, it sounds like a lot. It is a lot. But the cost of treating Alzheimer's otherwise is off the Richter scale, right?
That's right. Yeah, well, it is, right? Absolutely. I don't think we quite know, you know, how much it will reduce cost in that way. Mm-hmm. Some people, when you talk to docs, you know, doctors who give the drug to people, what I hear from them is I have some people on it that seem to be doing good. Other people, you know, not so much, but you know, that they do have people where it seems like they're, you know, not declining as fast as they otherwise would. And so, you know, anything that can keep people from, you know, needing full-time caretakers and all that sort of thing that comes with the disease could certainly reduce costs in the long run. Whether or not it will totally offset the drug cost, I think, remains to be seen.
Let's see. We have a caller, Brad in Clintonville. You're on the air. Hi, Brad.
Hello. About the side effects, I feel like the guest downplayed side effects, not mentioning that the side effects in one of the two studies occurred in 40% of the patients, and the side effects are brain swelling and brain hemorrhage. And in the treatment of the patients taking the drug, Medicare, therefore the taxpayer, will be on the hook for treating these patients that have the side effects of brain swelling and brain hemorrhage.
Okay.
And the brain accumulation of amyloid proteins is not definitively linked to causing Alzheimer's. And in the studies, the drug did not totally clear the amyloid plaques from the brain. So there's little evidence that links all this. The cost of the MRIs that are going to be given virtually every month, the cost of the treatment of the side effects. There's one word that describes why this was approved. That word is ka-ching. Thank you very much. Bye.
Okay, Brad, thanks. First of all, Joseph, I don't think you underplayed the side effects. I was going to actually do a follow-up on that and what they are, but be that as it may, there's a lot of wheels in motion here when it comes to a drug like this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There are. Your caller is very astute and very well informed. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think I can argue with much of what he said, other than the part at the end about you know, not all this coming together necessarily. I mean, that's in a subjective opinion. It's certainly a valid one, but you know, it is fair to say that obviously others disagree, including the FDA. But but in clearing the amyloid, what can happen is people get these bleeds in their brain. And according to the clinical trials, they were detected, you know, pretty quickly. People didn't really have too many bad symptoms from them, but it's serious stuff, you know. Like, I mean, nobody wants little tiny brain bleeds that they're dealing with. And because of that, the FDA label and doctors are going to require that patients get MRIs following up after these treatments to watch out for this side effect. And in some cases, like if it happens, you'll stop taking it and maybe you'll go back on it later. It'll sort of vary from case to case. But as your caller was saying, you know, the MRIs for the monitoring the side effects, as well as we think PET imaging scans to like confirm whether people actually have amyloid in their brains are also going to cost a lot of money for people.
That's above and beyond the cost of the drug.
Totally.
Okay. And the issue, another issue he brought up is the question of whether the amyloid proteins are a causation or a correlation. The fact they don't really know. They just know that they increase in people with Alzheimer's. They don't know if that's what's causing the symptoms.
It's fascinating because you know, we've known about amyloid for a very, very long time, you know, decades. Mm-hmm. And the thing that we know is that, like, it's always there, you know. It's like it's the dog that's always barking. And so it would sort of seem like an obvious target to go after with these drugs. And then all the drugs targeting amyloid just kept failing one after another. And many newspapers and reporters, including myself, wrote stories after these failures, including Biogen's, saying the amyloid hypothesis is dead now. You know, we tried and tried and tried and it's not working. We need to start over from scratch. And then with the FDA approval of this drug and also, you know, leading up to it, where people sort of thought that it was going to get approved because the FDA was open to it, it's now back again. And people are going after it more than ever. So, you know, to answer your question, I think that what scientists would say is that Alzheimer's is a multifactorial disease that's caused by a whole lot of things. And we don't really understand fully the pathology of this disease, even. It's very complex. We don't understand it that well. We know amyloid is there. But like ultimately to have really dramatic treatments, you're probably going to have things that are affecting that are affecting things other than just amyloid.
Joseph Walker, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Joseph Walker is a reporter. He covers the biotechnology and pharmaceutical industries for The Wall Street Journal. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up. We're going to kind of focus on that new variant of the COVID-19 with Dr. John Swartzberg of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Prices for goods and services in the U.S. spiked 5.4% in June from the previous year, marking the highest rate of inflation since 2008 and stoking fears of a reboot of 1970s runaway inflation. We talk about whether those fears are well-founded and whether the U.S. is on the right track to stave off an inflation emergency. That's coming up tomorrow on All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 to noon on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Delta variant is now the dominant strain of COVID-19 in the U.S., accounting for more than 8 out of 10 new infections in some parts of the country. Experts warn the variant could lead to new surges of COVID-19 if vaccination rates fail to keep pace with the spread. Dr. John Swartzberg is chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Welcome back, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning. Thank you.
What do we know about this Delta variant? What are we learning now?
Well, it already has caused a surge in the United States in selected places. Just look at southwestern Missouri, just for an example, where hospital beds are filling up, very reminiscent of those terrible days in last November and December. So it's already causing havoc here. You know, and we've been about 3 months behind England during this pandemic. We got the Alpha variant in the late winter and became the dominant strain here in the spring, and it came from the United Kingdom. And then the Delta variant, which was just causing havoc in the United Kingdom in late spring there, now is starting to cause havoc here. So that's what we're seeing. As you mentioned, it's the dominant strain here in the United States. The dominant variant of this virus is the Delta variant, and it's formidable, primarily because it's just a lot more transmissible. Of all of the different variants we've encountered with this virus, the Delta variant is far and away the most transmissible. So it spreads so easily between people compared to what we dealt with in November and December. In January. So it's presenting a tremendous problem, primarily because of its transmissibility. Whether or not it causes more severe disease remains a question mark at this point. But clearly, the transmissibility is the major issue with it.
The numbers that we're seeing, that there's more younger people getting sick from it. Is that just a correlation, or is that a causation? Do we know?
Well, that's a great question. If you look at the vaccine rates, what you need to dig down into those numbers a little bit. And for people 65 or over, the vaccination rates are very, very high in most places, not all places in the country. And with that, that's a group that's protected because the vaccines we have work quite well against the Delta variant. So the virus is going to go somewhere. And the only place it can go is to people who have no immunity against it. So it's going to find another population, and it does. And it's primarily younger people now. That's one of the explanations for why we're seeing more young people with this virus and the consequences of that. Another explanation is that, unfortunately, the message, although not clearly stated, but the message to the American public in May was that we're seeing the end of this. And in June, we've essentially seen the end of this pandemic here in the United States. And we can just enjoy ourselves like we were before the pandemic. And it's to a much larger extent, it's the younger population that is out and about now and not using the same precautions that were used for the first part of the pandemic. That is the non-pharmaceutical interventions, masking, social distancing, and not getting together in large congregate settings of people.
You said that we don't yet know if the Delta variant results in more severe disease, but you know, we do know that it's spreading to people who are not vaccinated in particular. And one of those large groups is young children, K-12 age. What are your thoughts about, I guess now someone as young as 14 can be vaccinated in the state of Ohio, but they've also passed a law that bans districts from requiring vaccination now. How do they collect data on the severity of the disease caused by the Delta variant? When do you think we might know whether it is more severe?
Well, the data on the Delta variant is being collected. Now that it's the dominant strain, it's a little difficult to know how much more severe it would be because we can't really compare it except to historical numbers. So it's going to be difficult to know whether it's more virulent or not. And frankly, I think that's not such a critical question. Okay. Because the critical question is how not to get infected, whether or not it's more virulent. It's sufficiently virulent to throw people in the hospital and to kill people. So that's enough for public health to want to do something about it.
But we heard, you know, before, at the beginning of all of this, the children and younger people, you know, young children and children, younger people in general aren't as affected by it.
That's true. That's been the case for all of the variants of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID. We're really blessed with that. You know, one mistake that was made very early on by scientists and public health professionals, and I include myself in that group of making the mistake, we thought when COVID began, it was going to be very much like influenza virus. And we know with influenza virus that children are a major reservoir for it. And the prime disseminators of this virus to adults of any age. So that's why schools closed down for the most part during the last academic year. Mm-hmm. We've learned a lot in the late fall, with good scientific studies over and over again showing that schools were not really a major problem. Parallel with that, we showed that particularly children under the age of 12, the chances of them getting sick were much smaller than any other part of our population. And the chances of them spreading the virus were much smaller. Over 12, the numbers start to approach adults.
Okay.
So that was really good news. And really the combination of those two things I mentioned represent the impetus behind getting kids back in classrooms, because there's a lot of morbidity, not just academic morbidity, but psychological morbidity in not having kids in schools.
Right. We're not vaccinating fast enough, though.
No, we're not. And it just breaks my heart. You know, we've got this. The only tool we had prior to the vaccine was the non-pharmaceutical interventions, the NPIs. Mm-hmm. And it worked fairly well if you were meticulous about them. But now we have this incredible tool that far exceeded anybody's expectations in terms of its efficacy and safety. And it's beyond me why people don't avail themselves of that, not only to protect themselves, but to protect everybody else around them. You know, we've been talking, our conversation began with the Delta variant. Variants come from people who are producing billions and billions of viral particles. That's the unimmunized. And when those billions of particles are being produced, some mistakes are made in its reproduction, and that's where a variant can occur. So if you have people immunized, they're not going to be viral factories and they're not going to be variant factories. So from society standpoint, if we don't want to be dealing with variants, get immunized. From your own individual standpoint, if you don't want to take the risk of getting sick, winding up in the hospital or dying, developing long COVID, get immunized. If you don't want to spread this virus to your loved ones and members of your community, get immunized. It's really tragic that we're not seeing a higher rate of immunization.
You brought up long COVID. You know, I did an entire show on that some months back. I'm wondering, how that's going for people? Is it for those folks who have quote unquote long COVID, are they still having it? Is it still an issue?
Some are getting better.
Okay.
After a number of months, and some are not. So there are people now who are suffering from whatever this is. For now, a good, well, now out to a year or so.
Yeah.
So it's This presents a long COVID presents a formidable problem because it's much more common than we thought. It may be multifactorial in origin, but it's resulting in tremendous morbidity for people. That is, too exhausted to do anything. Is just one of a myriad examples of what these folks are experiencing. And if this doesn't go away for a lot of these people, it's going to be a real difficulty for them and for society.
There has been a lot of talk about additional booster shots. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Pfizer said that may be on the horizon. Is that something we're going to end up needing as new variants continue to spread? Or what are your thoughts about that?
Well, that's a crystal ball question, and I'm not privy to that answer. All I can say is that there is no evidence today that people need a booster shot. The only two indications for a booster shot are if a variant occurs that is resistant to the immunity we get from our vaccines. If that happens, we're going to need a booster shot to cover that. The other indication for it is that if the immunity we get from our immunizations wanes so much that we're no longer able to fight off an infection. We haven't seen that yet either.
Okay.
So there's no clear indication for it.
The news this week, we learned that Johnson & Johnson vaccine may be associated with a small increased risk for Guillain-Barré syndrome. What is that? And should people who have gotten the J&J vaccine be worried?
The Guillain-Barré syndrome is something we've known about for well over 100 years, described by two French neurologists. And it occurs after a variety of infectious diseases, but it also occurs after some immunizations. And what we found with the J&J vaccine is that with the passive reporting system that we have in this country, about 100 people somewhere within 6 weeks of receiving the J&J vaccine developed the Guillain-Barré syndrome. So that comes out to about between 7 and 8 people per 100,000. And that was with around 13 million doses of J&J here in the US. The background noise, that is the number of cases we would see in people not being vaccinated and over the years, is around 1 out of 100,000. So depending upon how you want to parse these numbers, you could say if the glass is half empty, you're going to say that it's 7 to 8 times more common after the J&J vaccine, which sounds pretty bad. But if you say that it's 7 to 8 times out of 100,000 people getting the J&J vaccine, you realize your odds for getting that are extremely low. If you get it, the vast majority of people do get well. It's a paralysis that ascends from your feet up to your, can go all the way up and stop you from breathing. So it can be very dangerous, but we do have ways to treat it.
You referenced passive reporting system in this country. What does that mean?
Well, it's called VAERS, and it's a system that people report anything they experience after being immunized. And it's turned out to be a very good tool. The vast, vast majority of things that are registered by people in that system have no relationship at all to the vaccine. You know, you had the vaccine today and 4 days later, you fell down and broke a bone. People will report that, but there's no clear indication there. That what I mean by passive is we're counting on people reporting things as opposed to an active system where we're going out and seeking that information. That's one of a variety of tools, by the way, we use to monitor the vaccines, but it's turned out to be a good one. And that's where we picked up this association with the J&J vaccine.
We just have about 25 seconds left, but I wanted to ask you what you're looking at, what you're keeping an eye on, because the pandemic is still far from over.
Yeah, new variants is one thing. Another is how the Delta variant is going to play out in terms of how many more hospitalizations it's going to occur. Are we going to have something like last summer that peaked on July 28th? And the third thing, the vaccination numbers, because I can pretty much promise you that if we don't increase our vaccination numbers, we're going to increase our cases and hospitalizations and deaths.
Dr. John Swartzberg, thanks as always for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
That's Dr. John Swartzberg. He's chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.